Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Three inspirational women are the stars of our latest episode of Soundtracking, as we bring you another of our live events recorded at London's British Film Institute. Carly Paradis, Amelia Warner, and Emily Livanais-Farouche are all making big waves in the world of film composition, which, let's be honest, is, like the rest of the business, rather male-dominated. So it was an absolute pleasure to get them on stage together in front of an audience to celebrate their work. Though this was recorded quite a few months ago, we've held it back because on June the 12th in London, a new concert event celebrating the work of women composers in film and media will take place at Earth in Hackney. Carly, Amelia and Emily are amongst the composers being showcased, as well as Jessica Jones, Anne Nikitin, Kate Simcoe, Jessica Curry, Jocelyn Pook, Nanita Desai, Imogen Heap, Alev Lenz and Claire M. Singer. It's sure to be an absolutely cracking night. If you fancy going along, just head to earthhackney.co.uk for more information. And so to these wonderful women, who we'll get to after a short montage of their music.
Everybody, thank you so much for being here. This is our third outing here at the BFI, bringing the podcast here, and it's been a really lovely journey. Each one's been very different, and I'm so excited about today because the thing that I find the most frustrating about the podcast is having access to female composers and being able to enthuse about the wonderful work that they do. So when Anna and the team at the BFI asked me if I'd get involved in their fantastic Podstock Festival, I was like, yes. And then started approaching female composers that I really admire. And I'm so lucky and thrilled to have three of them here today to join us to not only talk about their work, we're also going to hear some of their fantastic work as well. So please make them feel welcome. For one of them, it's her very first time doing anything like this and talking about her work, particularly in public. Please put your hands together and welcome Carly Paradis, Amelia Warner, there we go, and Emily Levinas Farouche. Ladies! Oh yeah, grab a mic, sorry. I didn't know if you had a favourite colour, but you know, they go straight for the green. They're on, so you don't need to touch anything. There we go. Just remember to talk into them. Thank you so much for being here, from coming from close by, from, you know, out in the country, all that kind of thing. Thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate it. We're going to hear some great excerpts from your work throughout the session, but I thought it'd be really nice to kind of start by speaking to you all individually about your journey here and how that journey into composing for film and TV started and why it was something that you wanted to pursue as a career. Carly, do you want to start?
Yeah, so I think everybody's journey is different and there's no rule book on it. You kind of have to figure it out yourself. So for me, it was just starting playing piano at a really young age. So yeah, I just started writing little piano tunes at the age of 9 and then did the whole classical piano thing, but always loved the pop world as well. And I got my undergrad degree in music and multimedia because I liked the tech side of stuff. And then I joined an indie band locally in Canada.
Code?
It was a long time ago. I don't want to talk about it.
Come on, we've all been in bands with really bad names.
Well, over a drink, we'll talk.
Okay. I'll tell you my two if you want, if it makes you feel better. Warp Factor and Groovers on Maneuvers. I mean, come on.
It's like the Groover from Vancouver.
Exactly.
And then I was a substitute teacher because I needed to make money to fund, you know, recording and touring or whatever. I went to a lot of film and music conferences to meet people and learn. And then I always knew in my heart I wanted to do instrumental in film and television. And for me, the first door opening was one message to Clint Mansell, who's my hero. And it literally, you know, it was that first kind of step towards taking that career path, which I always wanted to do.
Amelia, what about you?
I came kind of quite a roundabout way, I guess. And I was an actress at first, so that was my kind of into film, I guess. Mm. And I loved it and I had a great time, but I realized quite quickly that I was doing the wrong bit. And though I loved the industry and I loved film and I loved that world, I didn't feel comfortable with my role in it. Mm-hmm. And so then I started, I'd always written music and I'd played the piano since I was little and kind of similar to you, I'd sat at the piano and wrote little stories. And so that had always been a part of my life and I'd always written music. And then I started to kind of, pursue that and take that more seriously. And I started to release some music. And I did a couple of commercials and I did a couple of short films for friends. And I always really enjoyed putting music to picture and definitely thought that it was something I wanted to do more of. And then I was releasing my own music and a director heard the EP and heard a track and kind of said, could we have the track for the film?
Great.
And I was like, well, yeah, you can have the track, but who's scoring it? And he was like, oh, we don't know. And I was like, well, you know, I could give you the track and I could write more tracks around that track. And that was the first, and that's how it kind of happened.
Did you ever use music when you were acting as performance to help you get into character or to help you discover character?
Yeah, it was definitely a huge part of it for me. And I think, and sometimes, you know, I loved it when you'd work on a film and the director would use music and play music. And, you know, that made such a difference for me.
Yeah. Emily, what about for you?
I think like all three ladies, or two other ladies here tonight, is just starting the piano from a classical point of view when I was growing up. And then, I don't know, I'm not from a very musical family. No one is a professional musician. So I didn't really take it as a potential career until I was in my early 20s. And then because of the way music education is in France, it became pretty clear that if I wanted to get to learn how to use a recording studio and the kind of more business aspect of the music industry, I would have to come to England. And so I came here to do a bachelor degree, and it was in a campus where there was film students, and film students need music. So I started doing short films with them, and that really got me hooked into, you know, how making music for moving images is completely different from writing your own music, and I really enjoyed that.
But that's something you all do. and you all have done and you all continue to do is write your own music and release your own music. Why is that important?
I think it's pretty different because when you make music for film, you kind of have to put... A film is not an excuse to make music. Mm-hmm. You have to become a filmmaker and kind of serve the project. But sometimes you have ideas or techniques that you would just want to have a go at and just pursue for yourself. And when you're recording your own music and releasing your own music, that also gives you that space. So both work pretty well together, I think.
It's a different approach. If of a day you're going, I'm going to work for me today, in terms of my stuff, rather than I'm going to work for this project. Do you approach it differently? Is it a different, not state of mind, but...
Yeah, I think like you were saying, you can kind of maybe take more risks or you can just try things out, whereas you're not going to do that on somebody's film or at the expense of a plot or a story. You're not going to be kind of messing around with big, with experimental ideas. And I think it's quite nice because with a film, you're always serving the film, and that's the most important thing. And you're always trying to achieve the director's vision and what he wants, she wants. And I think that with your own music, you can just kind of, it's like a clean slate. It's kind of like you can just be true to your own aesthetic, and you don't have to be factoring in those things. You can be more indulgent, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, I think it's important to explore your own voice, and it's just 100% you. And you also can own it, which you can't.
Not always do.
Yeah, so that's a nice thing to actually own your own music.
Yeah. Can you think about when you were... I mean, it doesn't need to be like when you were a kid, but those pieces of film or TV where the music really resonated with you, whether that be because of the composer or because of the collaboration between the composer and director, are there pieces that stand out to you or films that stand out to you that have either from an early age or even recently that have really resonated with you?
Yeah, for me, I think I was too young to watch the series, but it was Twin Peaks, and it was that opening beautiful score that blew my mind. So, obviously, Clint Mansell's Requiem for a Dream, that blew my mind as well.
Get to play on it though now.
I know, I'm like pinching myself on stage. I'm like, oh, but how about you guys?
Yeah, I think Twin Peaks for me as well, I remember that being a real kind of moment and a standout thing of going, oh wow, music can do this. It doesn't just have to be background. And then I remember seeing Michael Winterbottom film called Wonderland, and it's a Michael Nyman score, and it's this really gritty urban drama, and then there's this beautiful score, and it's so orchestral, and it's so warm, and it's so, and it just gave the film this dignity and this, in the juxtaposition of the two things, and I just remember thinking, oh wow, so music can do that.
Yeah,
and it was amazing.
Was it French cinema for you?
Well, I think it's also a Nyman film for me, but it's the piano. Because that was just mind-blowing. Yeah, growing up, I was watching a lot of French musical, the Jacques Demy ones, so Young Girls of Rochefort and all this thing, because, yeah, the music is so important in those, and that was really influential. Je l'ai cherché partout, tout autour de la terre, de Bali à Lima, des Cousettes aux Marquises, du ciel de l'île de Sein, au ciel de l'Idélie. Je l'ai couru partout et de partout j'espère. Le seul fait d'exister la rend incomparable. Le seul fait d'être là la rend plus désirable. Que mille filles nues dans mille rêves fous. J'ai fait le tour du monde, je l'ai cherché partout. Est-elle loin d'ici? Est-elle près de moi? Je n'en sais rien encore, mais je sais qu'elle existe. Est-elle pécheresse ou bien fille de roi? Star de cinérama ou modeste fleuriste? Je sais qu'elle m'appartiendra.
it was really nice. I think it was this year, I think, the piano had an anniversary, and yeah. So it got a kind of re-release on the big screen, and to kind of watch that film on the big screen was just, with that score, the piano was incredible.
It's incredible. It's just the film and the score are so married together. Like yeah. You cannot, I mean, they are so unified, and they almost don't stand, they do stand alone. I love listening to the score, but it's just, it's an amazing kind of marriage, the two things.
You've all very kindly brought pieces in as well that we're going to play. Emily, we're going to start with you, if that's okay. And what's lovely is that you had a film that premiered at the BFA London Film Festival just 2 weeks ago, I think it was.
It was 2 weeks ago.
Called Only You. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to be involved in the project and what appealed to you about being involved in it?
I think I came to the project through the producers, who are the Bureau, which is one of the best production companies in the UK, really like taking chances on young filmmakers. Yeah, I think they were still looking for a composer, even though they was picture locked, everything was quite advanced. And they asked me to come for a meeting, and I watched the film beforehand. And as soon as I watched it, I knew I really wanted to be on the project because it's just a really simple story, and everything on paper sounds so simple. But it's actually really hard to make it, to do it well. Mm-hmm. And I think that Harry really succeeded in creating this kind of intimacy, and everything worked. So I just prepared for that meeting and tried to make them understand I'd do my best work ever for them.
In that environment, do you have to play anything? How does it work? Is it an audition? Is it an interview? What's the kind of process?
In that case, it was so talking about how I would see approaching the score, but also they asked me to make little demos just to get a sense of what musically I would want to do. And I don't think we used any of the music from the demos, but it still gave them an idea of what direction I would go.
I really want to see the film. Congratulations. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's really interesting because that's a really good example, I think, of where the music's part of the narrative. There's no communication going on there verbally. There's no script. And your music's doing so much in terms of where those characters are. And so where did you start with that specific piece?
Well, that's the thing. What took the longest wasn't necessarily finding the melody, but finding the tone. And that was just through talking with the director.
We're going to hear another piece, just audio now. We'll play it first and then we'll come back and talk about it. This is another piece from Only You. Thank you. talked a little bit about the creation of that, because there's more to it in terms of the instrumentation and mm-hmm. beautiful kind of use of string instruments in there as well.
I think pretty early on, talking with the team, because the film is really intimate and it's shot in a really intimate manner, that we thought the instrumentation should stay pretty intimate as well. So we kept it to piano and cello. And on this one, I recorded the piano. So again, the tone was really important because it influenced as well the way I would play the piece. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just
does it all start on the piano? You know, in terms of when, and is that the same for all of you when you sit down to think about creating a piece for either a scene or you're trying to find a theme or a mood or an emotion and stuff? Does it all start sat down at a piano, or
sometimes it's just into my phone recording
singing?
Yeah, like some kind of a rhythm or singing or. Yeah. Something really weird I will never show you.
Wish you'd brought that clip with you.
But for me, mostly, the piano is, I find that's the best way I can get out what I'm feeling or trying to connect with the script or the character or a scene or atmosphere or whatever.
Yeah, I've got hundreds of voice notes on my phone, and they usually when I'm out on a walk, like something will kind of appear in my head. But yeah, they're just awful. And then really embarrassing, like, you know, they're in the cloud and they end up transferring onto a computer, and it was just like, oh my God.
Beatboxing.
Oh, it's just awful. But yeah, I usually always start at the piano.
Yeah. Emma, can you talk about as well this, you know, this project? Was this your first full length feature, or?
I had done other ones before, but micro budgets or like art documentary. But in terms of one that's going to have a cinema release, yes.
Is that exciting for you?
Yes. Very much so, yeah.
Because you had your first, or you had proper experience during the London Film Festival mm-hmm. where you sat and watched it with an audience. Yeah. What was that experience like?
It's really interesting for all the more comedic moments, because when you just watch it in like in a room with three other people, it's kind of difficult to know how funny they are. And then you're in a room with, you know, I don't know, maybe like 300 other people, and people are laughing, and it just feels it feels great. It really feels good, because you really know it's working.
Yeah.
And that you can only know with an audience.
And how does it feel to hear your score?
Painful, I'm not going to lie. It's very difficult to not think about, like, how is it sounding? How is the mix sounding?
Yeah.
I'm still very critical of it. Even just now. Yeah.
Really?
It's uncomfortable. Oh, I'm not going to lie.
We all loved it. Wasn't it great? We've got another piece to listen to as well. Can you talk a little bit about scale of, I can't even say it now, volatility?
Yes. Yeah. So that's from my first album. Again, when we were talking about how making your own music can allow you to just try out ideas that would not necessarily have their place in a film, that's exactly that. I just wanted to... And it's still pretty cinematic. It's still piano and string quartet from the London Contemporary Orchestra. But it was just for me. It's just a guilty pleasure.
It's so cinematic. Have you had, that's from the first record, Epoch, the second record was out just a couple of months ago?
Yes, in July.
I can imagine, you know, it's a great way as well of showcasing mm-hmm. to people the type of thing that you can do as well, you know, when there are no restrictions. Is that kind of, not what you're thinking about, but what it gives you the opportunity to do?
It does. It does create a really nice call card. And yeah, it just
allows... called me. Yeah, after I heard that song, I asked Emily to collaborate on custom effects for Netflix, The Innocents. Because yeah. I thought it was wicked.
Amazing.
Sorry, I'm like butting it.
No, no, it's good, please. It worked.
Yeah, it did. It did work. But it's true. I mean, it's very good, especially when you're starting out and you don't necessarily have the biggest portfolio of music for film. Suddenly you have 40 minutes of instrumental music that you really love.
Yeah.
And that you've worked on for months and months, and you can send that and show what you're capable of doing. And I think it really helps and really makes a difference.
Carly, we're going to move on to you. We've got some great stuff to show from you. I mean, it feels like you've been so busy as well. I mean, it's been nonstop really for you. I mean, quite a lot of series, which I want to kind of talk about what that involves in terms of the workload, because...
No sleep.
Have you started Line of Duty Series 6 yet? No, 5.
Yeah, so 5's filming right now.
Okay.
And then 6 will film next year.
But you already know you're doing that. That's kind of like...
My agent's working
possibly
on it.
But when you work on something that's a series, obviously there are familiar themes that recur, like... the theme tune up to the series and stuff, but every episode is a completely new thing.
Yeah. Line of Duty was wicked because I got to be myself, and they were looking for a fresh take on the cop procedural drama.
Yeah.
In this case, cop corruption. And yeah, it's great because I'm also a huge fan of themes. So I got to write a cool theme at the end credits and the opening. And actually, the end credits theme, I wrote the bones of it from reading the scripts of series one, because you can get a lot from just the script. Jed is a brilliant human being and writer. So that, you know, and the team is awesome. So it's very inspirational. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here.
No, it's good. Just keep talking.
All right. So the TV series, it's cool because once the hardest part, and I don't know if you guys find this as well, the hardest part is the very beginning. You got a blank canvas and you've got to find the tone. You got to find the themes, the melodies, what works, what doesn't.
Yeah.
But once you nail episode one, it tends to flow better. And this was a great series because they wanted to keep that tone throughout. So, you know, reworking, evolving themes, some new stuff, but in general, keeping that Line of Duty voice throughout.
To work on it.
Okay, so yeah, again, our journeys are so weird and different. And for that one, luckily, Clint Mansell, who I've been working with and touring with, he put my name in the hat because he'd worked with that production company before. And then also Jake Lushington, who I worked on 2 of his short films, it was a huge fly.
Go away. He's been on the screen and everything.
Sorry about that. I worked on 2 short films with him, and he put my name in the hat, and he ended up working at the production company. Mm-hmm. So I got my foot in the door for the interview, and then they asked to do a demo, and I did a demo on some of the rough scenes, and it was what they were looking at. So it's a lot of being ready, luck, and timing, and with that, you know, the show took off, you know, and it's doing amazing.
It's so good. And we're going to hear, actually, the I think it's the end title. It's what we're going to hear from Line of Duty
the end
here.
Credits.
And then we'll talk about it after this.
That's like an, you know, an office bell, like in the olden days, it's like, ding, I need service. Because I thought of them sitting at their desks.
Someone coming up going, there's been a murder.
Yeah. You know my secrets.
Totally. And now that hearing that reminds me of normally like watching the telly and going, no, at the end of an episode.
I wanted, you know, because again, Jed so brilliantly writes the ending to have these major cliffhangers at the end.
Yeah.
So I wanted this feeling of a runaway train, downward spiral, and we're going somewhere, and grab the edge of your seats because it's going to be bad.
And so they're shooting 5 at the minute and you're about to start the music on it, or have you started yet?
Actually, I've only read script 1. I need to read some more stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
So probably end of this month.
Wow. And how does it work with that then? They give you the script, or do you get rough edits of, or what do you get fed to then kind of compose to?
Well, usually we get the scripts to read and then we talk to the team and talk about all of the ideas and what they're looking for. With this, because it's an episodic and it's into series 5, it would be, going through maybe the rough cut of episode 1 and talking with Jed and the you know, producers, editor, what they're looking for, if there's any new thematic elements to want to talk about.
Is it, I don't want to say more work, because it's a different experience, I imagine, working on a series than it is a one-off film or a one-off episode.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of music that you have to make for series is a lot more, and it's in a shorter time frame usually. But yeah, again, you can rework and reuse stuff. And it's cool because you can kind of, you have more time, I guess, to learn about the characters and develop more. And this has been going on since 2011 now, so... Yeah, you get to know, you become a family, like you get to know everybody, you know, working on it, and it's a real joy when you get in that scenario.
So do you have different directors coming in the whole time? Is it kind of constantly changing? You must be one of the people who've been on it the longest almost at this stage.
There's 2 blocks, because the way the schedule works, they need to shoot, you know, block 1 with one editor and one director, and then they start editing and working on that while the other block, director and editor, are doing their thing. But there has been some consistencies, but there's also been, some directors that come in for one block. Because it's kind of cool to, like, learn a lot and meet all these great talents.
We're going to talk about The Innocents, which, if you haven't seen yet, is a fantastic Netflix series, and the music is incredible in this. It really is.
Oh, thank you.
Congratulations. We're going to hear a clip of it right now.
I
I mean, that should be released as a single.
It's coming out on my next album.
Is it?
Which I'm going to be recording this month, the other tracks. Yeah.
And with vocal, what did you talk about that kind of, you know, the idea of adding a vocal into it and how that kind of came about and why you wanted to go down that route?
Actually, it's kind of a funny story. Because the end credits, they were about 38 seconds long, and I wrote a couple ideas, and then the instrumental version of this ended up as the ending. And then episode two came, and the end credits were a minute long, or a minute and something seconds. And I go, hold on, I've already recorded and mixed the end. So it was an opportunity as well, because I was in the studio at AIR with London Contemporary Orchestra, and I had them record. I had written a song version of it anyway, just to put up my sleeve, and I had them record the strings. So when that happened, I was like, okay, cool. Well, I actually already have a longer version. I'm going to edit that down. And then I had these lyrics, and then I demoed really horribly my voice over it to show the team, and they liked with voice on it because the show is quite epic and cinematic. And so I literally had like a day or two or whatever to get in, wow. Book a, you know, singer. And I had this artist named Ira, her name is Anna, she's from Norway. And it was kind of a cool combo to have a Norwegian singer,
yeah,
you know, and then record all the stuff with British musicians because it's all shot in Norway and the UK. And so it turned out really cool. I'm really happy that it turned out like that. Mm. So the moral of the story is always have little things up your sleeve and always extend your cues when you're writing them. You never know what's going to happen.
Is that sometimes how it works, where they'll kind of go, we need 42 seconds worth for this bit? Is that how it can work sometimes? Is it that kind of sort of specific?
Well, I guess the spot sessions, right? We all do our spot sessions, yeah, with the team and find where the cues are going to go, how long they're going to be.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah,
then it's not very flexible. Usually, you know, they are 15 seconds or 10, you know, and they don't really, you can't kind of say, yeah, but could you just
let it run for
a bit longer because I really like this melody. And
it's, you know, more reverb.
Yeah. What about, I know you're a sci-fi fan, so kind of entering that world and you creating this score for that, was that fun? And do you think about that specifically with genre, you know, going into it differently with a different genre?
Yeah, for instrumentation, I was kindly loaned this SX1 by Digitana. There's this chemistry prof here in London. By day, he's a chem prof. And then in the evening, he'll modify, like, mod synths. And him and Future Sound of London made this SX1 module that I got to play with. And at the time, there's only, you know, three of them that existed. Wow. So that was great to get in there and mess around with that. But the story for me, you know, it was the relationship of the mothers and their daughters and finding your, you know, being, finding yourself kind of, mm-hmm, you know, that whole journey of,
yeah,
we're all made up of bits of pieces of characters and all and people, but, you know, to be accepting of who we are.
Yeah.
So for me, it was it's an emotional story. And that's why a lot of the themes were, there would be some, you know, emotional thematic stuff, but then there'll be some kind of wild, bold, dark, you know, electronic side, yeah, as well.
we talked about Clint earlier as well, and you obviously had that kind of experience with working with him on Moon and that kind of world of sci-fi as well.
Yeah, when I was recording the piano at Remote Control Studios in Santa Monica, there was this gigantic, like 12 foot, I think it was an alien from the Alien movie, I think, in the corner, like literally staring me down for 10 hours recording Moon.
Wow.
So it was a great experience. Yeah.
We've got a little grand piano there. Would you mind just...
I feel like I'm on Graham Norton. I gotta go do something here.
Yeah. We've got one here. Would you mind just kind of showing us kind of where that, how that, that kind of developed, that kind of Moon sound?
Sure. I mean, yeah.
I'll come with you and I'll mic
you. The genius. And then...
There's no stairs.
That's okay.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I've been working out.
I should have left it down and I could have lay across it like fabulous. Yeah. Like Michelle Pfeiffer. But yeah, that's just another dream. Okay, hold on. I'm going to come down.
Okay.
Right, I'll hold the mic so you can talk about what you're going to play.
I'm taking tips, people. All right.
Should have had a brandy glass at the end here. That would have been a great idea.
I mean, yeah, so when we play this live, I literally am playing the melody in the right hand, and then Clint is playing the other part. It's been so long now.
When did you last play live with him?
We played, I think it was 2017, I think?
At the Royal Festival Hall.
Yeah, we did Glasgow.
Yeah,
it was at Royal Festival Hall.
I came to that one. It was amazing. Ben Wheatley introduced them.
Yes.
Yeah, that was special. Yeah.
I know we're due. We need to go touring.
Yeah, come on.
Okay, sorry. So, I mean, I haven't played... Okay, anyway. Oh my lord. Literally, I don't play this with two hands.
I feel like I have put you under pressure here. Oh.
I mean, like, but the simplicity of his stuff is so incredible. And like, you know, on the fountain. Like he just boils it down to its pure essence, and that's such a great lesson to learn, like to actually take elements away from music and this pure beauty and simplicity that he's a master of.
Thank you for playing that.
Oh, that sorry, was really it wasn't very good. We're gonna practice my moon.
Amazing, thank you, Carly. Yeah, UK, sure.
I'm gonna roll on.
We're good. We have got a clip of Welcome to Lunar Industries from Moon, actually, which I think we're going to play right now. I was lucky enough to watch you guys play that at a place called the Largo in LA.
Yeah, yeah.
Which about 8 years ago, I think it was. And it's kind of the reason that I do this podcast, to be honest, because kind of watching that show, it was a real influence in terms of going, wow, we need to talk about this.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's like he's very much part of the reason that this podcast exists, sort of thing. And he's you know, you were talking up earlier about you wrote him a letter, or you asked his advice, or you asked for whatever it was that you asked, and getting that response. And you say that's a really good piece of advice for people to kind of, you know, don't be scared to ask.
Yeah, I tell everybody the worst case scenario is a no or no reply, and no harm done there. You just never know, because with that one MySpace message sent in like 2006 or whatever, that opened up an entire new life for me, really. And that's kind of why I'm here too. Like, it just, I just told him what, you know, what I thought of his music and how it made me feel. And he actually replied. And then we were discussing stuff that we were working on at the moment. And then I was in LA for the first time, 2007, at a music film conference. And then we grabbed a coffee and, you know, kept in touch. And then, 6 months later, needed a pianist for Ghent Film Festival, and then got that whole band to play on Moon. So it's just, you never know how things can happen unless you try. You know, or ask.
It's like you were saying as well, when someone wanted to use your piece of music and you were like, I'll do the score.
Yeah, I think you just have to take those chances when they present themselves, because exactly what's the worst they can say? Oh, we've already got someone. You go, okay, well, yeah, that's fine.
Was that from Mum's List?
Yes, it was, yeah.
What then, did they then send you the script and sort of be specific about what they wanted, or how did it work with Mum's List?
Yeah, it was quite unusual with Mum's List, because I got involved really, really early. So they just wrapped, I think, and they were just starting the edit. And so I was involved all the way through the edit, whereas usually you come on, you know, when it's locked or a bit later on in the process. So it was amazing, and it was incredible being part of it for the whole way through. But it was hard, because you write something and then a week later that scene's gone, or it's moved, or it's shorter, or it's longer. So it ended up being a lot more work in a way, because I was just redoing everything. But it was amazing not having to deal with the temp score. Like, I was so spoiled the first time, because I just didn't know about temp score and I didn't have to worry about it. And I got to kind of create the sound of that film.
Yeah.
And they edited to that music, which was really amazing.
Well, your music was almost the temp score, really, wasn't it? In terms of, you know,
exactly.
Amazing position to be in.
Yeah.
The story is so emotional. The book is so emotional. When you're kind of going into the emotion of the music and stuff, did you want to try and not hold back on it, but simplify it? Or what were you thinking about, or what were the conversations that you had about the music emotionally with it?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an emotional story, and the subject matter is just, it's so hard to not be moved.
Yeah.
And so initially the director and I talked a lot about trying to, to kind of hold back on that emotion and not be too bold, with, you know, just try and be really delicate.
Yeah.
But then actually, as we went on and on, I just remember, you know, the director would be like, I think we need more strings. I think we need more. Because initially I said, I don't think there should be any strings, or I think we should really try and just keep it piano as much as possible. And then it would get bigger and bigger. And I get, you know, because it warranted it, I guess. It was just, it was so sad.
Yeah.
And you kind of needed the music to mirror that.
We've got a lovely piece of Kate that we're going to play right now. Let's talk about Mary Shelley, because I this director that you work with, she is absolutely incredible. I think that I can't say her name probably. Haifa Al-Masur. She's a really incredible filmmaker in terms of the way that she kind of really gets to the heart of women in her storytelling. And I just love the way that she told Mary Shelley's story in this film.
Yeah.
Where did you start with the music with this, and with the addition of it being period, and look into that in terms of if that influenced the tone and the instrumentation or any of that.
So Mary Shelley was really different to Mum's List, as in I came in really late, so it was completely locked. And actually, Haifa had kind of gone back to LA, so I didn't really get to spend that much time with her or talking to her. It was incredible because she was very clear, and she was kind of and she'd listened to some of my music, and she was kind of happy with it. But then she really did let me kind of get on with it, which was amazing. And I think that the fact that it was a period film, of course, was a consideration, and it definitely influenced the sound that we ended up with. But the producers were also really, really keen that it not feel like a period score.
Yeah.
And they didn't want it to feel too grand or too polite or too stilted or too polished. Or they wanted it to have a kind of rawness and a youth and to feel kind of, and a freshness. And actually the temp score that they had on that was really interesting because they had lots of tracks. They had like Agnes Obel, and they had some amazing pieces and tracks, and the tracks worked really well, which was interesting because you wouldn't expect that they would.
Yeah.
So that was, once we saw that and once we all kind of agreed, wow, that really works, then I was a lot freer than I would have been. I didn't feel bound to, or it has to be something that existed in that time.
Yeah.
That's kind of why I ended up using voice as well, because the tracks had worked so well. So I knew I wanted to have vocal there. And then I used lots of different synths and electronics and atmospherics and kind of in with the orchestra as well, mm-hmm. just to give it a kind of, you know, slightly more contemporary feeling.
Nice, because normally if when we speak to composers, their bugbear is that temp score, you know, it's kind of like, just, you know, you kind of go, so yeah, we put this temp score, if you can kind of do something kind of similar to it, that would be great. It's kind of like, but that's, I guess, a good example of where temp score actually was a benefit or a kind of a help in terms of you creating something very different and very unique, but it being a really good kind of framework as to give you an idea.
Yeah, I think it can be really helpful. I mean, it can be a huge burden because you're never, you know, often, especially if someone's fallen in love with a piece and you're not going to be able to recreate that exact piece.
Yeah.
And nor would you want to. Mm. But it was, in this case, it was actually really liberating because I think the editor had come. I think they'd had one cut where they had a really traditional period score. Mm. And then they'd got a new editor in and he just kind of completely changed it. And he put loads of Max Richter and he put lots of really cool stuff on there, and I think that kind of suddenly made the producers go, oh, okay, so we don't have to play it safe and go down this road. So it was a really useful tool, actually.
what I love about it, and it's a beautiful album to listen to as a piece of music outside of it being part of this film. And the film is available to watch on, I think I got it on Amazon to watch as well. It's up there to watch now. Go and check it out. It's Elle Fanning, isn't it? Yeah, she's incredible.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She's so brilliant as Mary Shelley. It's inspired casting. But I love how it's unpredictable, you know, and particularly that track in terms of you hear those sort of choral voices and you think you know where it's going to go and then it surprises you. Yeah. And that's really wonderful. And I guess that's part of, is that the nice kind of luxury to have where you can experiment?
Yeah, it was really nice. And I think that cue that we just heard actually was one of the hardest ones to get. And it was one of the last ones that we got right. You know, that it had lots and lots of incarnations because it was kind of setting her up. And it's the first time you see her and you see her and she's in the graveyard and she's writing. So you're kind of immediately in this like gothic world of Mary Shelley. But then it also wanted to be, but she's this 17-year-old girl and she's playing truant from home. And she's, you know, it was kind of trying to set up that she was a bit of a rebel and just trying to distill her character in that first kind of time we see her.
How did you form those kind of the melodies of those choral voices? Was that an easy thing? Because there's moments where they marry and there's moments where they're kind of, you know, there's almost like confrontation almost.
Yeah, I knew I wanted to do almost something that would work in a round. Yeah. So I remember that thing of like being a kid and singing like that Rose, Rose, Rose Red, or, you know, those ones that you all kind of start singing. So I knew I wanted to do something like that because I knew that I thought that it would work really well later on when everything starts to go a bit darker and kind of slightly morph and twist and you can play around with it. So it was just finding three melodies that could kind of link and circle and play at the same time. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think how long, I can't remember exactly how long it took to get that combination, but there were definitely, I think there were combinations where there were like six different ones or, you know, and then kind of bringing it down because it got a bit complicated.
Like that fly, just
persistent,
trying
isn't
to
it?
Get a front row seat.
Persistent. And we've got another clip we're going to play for Mary Shelley right now. It's amazing the imagery that music can evoke, you know, and I know some of you have not seen Mary Shelley in terms of be so interested to hear what the imagery that music evokes in your head. And that's really clever because, well, do you want to talk about where that piece of music's placed and what the kind of story behind that piece is?
So it's placed, she goes to, it's when she kind of sees the galvanization process. So she goes to this kind of freak show almost and this Victorian circusy show and she sees a frog be brought back to life. And it's very kind of campy and big, but you just see something, you know, a light inside of her, and it's almost like her creativity is awoken and you see this happening inside of her. So it was trying to, I guess, demonstrate that her inner world and her kind of, yeah, her creativity was beginning, and that story, that seed was being planted.
Thank you so much for being here today. We've run out of time. I was going to ask you what's next, but I don't want to ask you that. I want to ask you what's next on your list that you want to do. Who wants to answer that first? What do you want to do?
I'd love to do a Black Mirror episode.
Oh, nice. Have you spoken to Clint about that and his experience of it?
No, but I loved what he did.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
There we go. Black Mirror. Amelia?
I wouldn't know specifically what, but yeah. I just want to do something that, you know, that I get excited about and that is something that I can really get my teeth into and that has amazing story, amazing characters, and, you know, and work with a brilliant director. So yeah. I don't mind in what genre, I don't mind in what, you know, for TV or film, or but just it's more about that kind of responding to something.
Yeah. Emily?
Yeah, it's about the same. It's just the collaboration. That's the most interesting part when you make film, is just working with people that, you know, you respect, and just the same.
And the great thing is with the three of you is that, you know, in between those moments where you aren't working on a specific project, you're releasing your own music, which is brilliant. So please keep doing that as well. Thank you guys for being here today. Please can you give a huge round of applause to Emily, Amelia and Carly.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for having us. It's amazing.
Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks so much.
So there you have it. Composers Amelia Warner, Carly Paradis and Emily Leavenaise Farouche, recorded live at the BFI. My huge thanks to all three for taking the time to talk to us. Their work is widely available via the usual channels, and I highly recommend checking it out, be that their score for TV and film or indeed their own solo material. All utterly wonderful. Don't forget to head to earthhackney.co.uk if you fancy seeing some of it performed live by the London Contemporary Orchestra too. Now, we'll put a Spotify playlist up for this show via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to catch up with all of our previous episodes, including the three conversations I've had with Clint Mansell about various projects. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And if you do, you'll be in with a shout of winning a huge amount of film-related swag too. Next up then is the return to Soundtracking of an Academy Award-winning director who's already taken us into the worlds of Amy Winehouse and Ayrton Senna, and now unveils his documentary about the one and only Diego Maradona. Asif Kapadia is next week's guest. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. Your number two burns the hair in my nose, but we fought hand in paw. Now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.